Hi everyone, this is Austin Arrington from Plant Group and your host of Talk Dirty. Today is episode number 2, Gardening in Times of COVID. We've got some really awesome guests today, including an ecologist researching the effects of COVID on community gardens,
as well as an urban farming entrepreneur and green architect. All right, y'all, let's talk dirty.
So my name is Tomasz Wokowski. I'm presently a postdoctoral researcher at Cornell University, soon to be an assistant professor of forestry at New Mexico Highlands University. And most of my research and teaching interests focus on agroecology and socio-ecological systems. So really trying to consider the intersection between social and economic systems and how that interacts with ecological systems and our management of them.
Can you explain that word you used, agroecology?
Yeah, so agroecology is three things. And you ask 10 different agroecologists what agroecology is, and they're likely to give you 10 different answers. But my personal favorite is agroecology is a science, it's a practice, and it's a movement. So science, it's about understanding the ecological processes that are necessary to allow agricultural systems to function, right? So plants take up nitrogen and then they decay, returning nutrients to the soil, right? So looking at these biochemical cycles and interactions with pollinators and things like that. So understanding the science is one aspect of agroecology, but then there's also the practice, right? So farming in particular ways that try to harness those processes is an agroecological model of farming, right? Most farming that in the U.S. is done conventionally by just putting in tons of fertilizer and pesticides and trying to control these variables as much as possible to bend them to what we want them to be. And agroecology really thinks about how do we use these processes instead of trying to control them. And then finally, it's a movement, right? So it's tied into these social, economic, political struggles that are happening now, particularly in the global south. So there's organizations like Via Campesina that are really trying to mobilize small farmers, most of whom practice agroecology, to advocate for their behalf so that they get more power in these social systems which have historically marginalized them.
And when I met you, I feel like you were doing research and work around traditional ecological knowledge with agroforestry. Can you maybe explain that a little bit, your research?
Yeah, I got into that a little bit. And it was kind of luck of the draw. I must admit, when I started that work, I wanted to just do restoration research, particularly in the tropics. And I found Stu DeMont, who is both of our advisors, and he told me about this project that he was starting, looking at using traditional Maya agroforestry to restore forest while at the same time maintaining traditional cultural practices and providing local people with the food that they needed to survive. And that just seemed such a novel approach to restoration, because so much of restoration is really technical. We're just trying to grow trees in the tropics. And this was such a different approach that I was really intrigued. And as time went on, I saw myself getting more and more involved in the agroecology side of things as opposed to the restoration side of the project. And so I still do consider myself a restoration ecologist to some degree, but most of the work that I am doing now has some sort of food component, just because I think it's such an important issue, both in terms of ensuring food security and food sovereignty for people, but also because it's a really effective means, I think, and a lot of research supports this, of connecting people to place, which is something that's really important for the sake of sustainability.
Mm. And it seems like your work now, more recently, is still about food, but you've been involved with researching community gardens in New York, and like, so how did you through agroecology, how did you go from, you know, studying Mayan agroforestry to connecting that to something, you know, maybe more relatable to people in the States, which is community gardens?
It all happened really because of COVID. I was actually in Mexico this past year, and I left the morning things really kind of went haywire, where COVID went from some kind of vaguely distant threat to something that we're all still dealing with now. And so I arrived in Mexico and the situation was changing really quickly. And I wasn't sure whether I was going to stay in Mexico, whether this was going to explode, whether it was going to kind of lay low for a while. It turned out to be the former. And so I wound up returning from Mexico without really being able to get out into the field. And I suddenly thought to myself, this is an opportunity to consider systems in a way that I've never had before, that quite frankly, none of us have had before, and hopefully we'll never have again, at least within our lifetimes, right? And so I wanted to consider what could I provide as a researcher to the institutions that I think are most important to people in this really scary time. And started talking to Stu, who has remained a close friend and collaborator. And he discussed this other project that was going on, that Ashmita is working on, our colleague, regarding community gardens. And we wanted to kind of do some kind of extension of that specifically related to COVID. And that was kind of the birth of the idea. At the same time, I was working in a community garden for the first time. I came back and I didn't have a field season to do. And my partner and I, we decided we wanted to try a garden. And it's something I've wanted to do, both of us have wanted to do for quite some time. The backyard is not particularly sunny and very rocky. And so we found a local community garden and we started working in it. And we just really quickly realized how special of an institution it is within the community. I initially approached it as just like, okay, this is going to be a garden and it's just going to happen to be around other people's gardens. And I realized very quickly that it's so much more than that. And so that really spurred me to want to work further on this and together. We managed to come up with a project that I think is pretty interesting and will hopefully be beneficial to the gardens themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. So just for the listeners, to Mac, and myself, as well as Stu Demont and some other researchers, are all involved in a new research project. Can you tell us a little about it?
Yeah, the project is using a mix of surveys, of interviews with gardeners and garden managers in community gardens throughout New York, particularly focused on Ithaca, Buffalo, Binghamton, and New York City. And we are considering how COVID is impacting their community garden experience. Some of the effects are negative, many of them are, some of them are positive. And learning from that, how community garden organizations can balance the health and safety of their gardeners with the benefits that the gardeners derive from the gardens, right? So I guess the safest option, the lowest risk option, would to just be to close the gardens, right? Because then you don't have, it is an institution that brings people together. That's the nature of a community garden. That would nullify any kind of benefits that it provides, of course, but it's the safest option. And so we don't want that, obviously. That creates a lot of problems for people who depend on these gardens for food security. Then there's other people who derive lots of other benefits, like ensuring time spent outside, stress relief, which, boy, that's really important in a time like this. Physical exercise, in a time when gyms are closed and people aren't able to go to the gym, getting that physical exercise is really important. It's a connection to culture. All of these things are really valuable. And so how do we ensure that people still get all those benefits while trying to mitigate the risks posed by COVID in these sorts of community settings?
That's so interesting. You know, in a similar way, some of the gardens that I've been, you know, in touch with in New York during COVID, it's like hearing these firsthand experiences of, wow, having this space has been such a lifesaver for me during this time. It does make you think we should really be thinking seriously about what are the public health benefits of these parks and green infrastructure, and how does that inform our decision making around access to those spaces in times of the pandemic.
Yeah, because I mean, it's for a lot of people, and I mentioned that the safest thing would be to close the gardens, and that's true from, you know, perhaps a COVID transmission standpoint, but a lot of people really do depend on these gardens for a good chunk of the food that they get. And so it's absolutely, we talk about, you know, essential businesses and essential services, and I very much believe that community gardens are one of those things. And in a time when so many of us are social networks, something I didn't mention before is the social benefits and the help that it gets to build community. The community that comes together in these gardens is then, in a time when we are forced to be apart, because of COVID, we can still retain a sense of solidarity with one another through these gardens. And that's another really important aspect in a time when it seems so fraught and dangerous, that these things can really bring a lot of hope and joy to people in a time when there isn't too much of that.
Well, yeah, and I think also the gardens and parks are one of the few types of spaces where it should actually be possible to be in a social setting, but yet still maintain, you know, whatever 6-foot radius or it should be possible to do that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, from at least based on the preliminary results that we've been seeing, that is the case, that gardens have done a really good job. I'll say this right up front. Gardens have done a phenomenal job of keeping their gardeners safe. And so there are certain situations depending on the particular arrangement of the garden. So if it's very small, then that you have certain limitations there. But a lot of them, they really do allow for people to maintain their distance and to maintain some kind of relationship with the other gardeners safely without necessarily exposing themselves. And so I think we have seen this in practice. One of the things that we noticed in doing a review of literature back when we were proposing the project was that people are spending a lot more time in parks, in these sort of green spaces. Partially, and I can't really speculate as to why that is, but I'm sure it's a combination of wanting to connect to nature in these times. There's a certain degree of comfort there, but also the fact that we feel safer in these open areas. And so moving into winter, I think it'll be, we'll see how that progresses for sure. But I know for myself, I can only speak for myself with this, but now that the garden season is concluded here in New York, I've definitely found it harder to get outside and I'm trying to invent reasons. Whereas with the garden, it was a very obvious way to get outside. Yeah, you got to get to the garden to take care of things.
Right. So as we are, because, you know, as you say, it's over, but in my mind, I'm like, it's right around the corner. So, as things are, world is still up in the air with COVID-19, is your decision-making going into this next season any different as a gardener? Are you thinking about things differently right now for the spring?
I'm in a somewhat unique position because I am moving to New Mexico, which is a decidedly different sort of environment than New York. I suspect we'll be growing a lot more chilies than here. And actually, this past season, the chilies did not turn out very well. So hoping for better luck on that front next year. In terms of the COVID situation, it'll be interesting to see. On the one hand, I don't think that a lot of community gardens, at least from the conversations that I've had with managers, they don't really think that all that much is going to change. And their planning moving forward is that we're just going to stay the course. They've developed largely a model that works for them. And they're going to be trying new things, but by and large, they're just going to be making sure that they can stay open and provide the services that their gardeners need. For myself, I wouldn't really anticipate anything new. The one thing that I would be curious to find is, and this would require a little bit of research, but is we've seen a number of kind of fads come and go throughout the pandemic. People kind of latch onto a new idea. So at one point, everyone was baking sourdough, it seems. And I think the run on flour and stuff like that. And as a baker myself, I was both pleased by this, but also frustrated because all of a sudden I didn't have flour or anything like that. But we saw a similar thing with seeds, right? At the beginning of the growing season where seed orders were up like 300% and there were massive seed shortages, things were back ordered. And throughout the growing season this year, there were some difficulties acquiring supplies by some people. I know for myself, I found it really hard to find a watering can. I went to like three stores, could not find a watering can. So there was a big run on resources, kind of as the supply lines didn't really know how to shift and adapt in the changes of demand. And I'm curious, one, whether those supplies will have adapted this go round. I expect that they will have, but I would now wonder if perhaps our interest collectively, societally, has perhaps waned. Based on the interviews that we've been doing, most people are super excited to continue garden. Most people who have perhaps been first-time gardeners this year, they want to do it again because they see all the benefits that it provides them. So that's going to be really exciting. And once again, just underlines the importance that these gardens provide to people and how powerful they can be.
All right, y'all, let's switch it up. I'm about to talk to Doug Adams.
What are your expectations 2021, you know, this coming year in terms of really being able to utilize the event space? And if so, how is it contingent on the virus? Are you looking at social distancing protocols? Like, what has that thought process been like?
Well, being that the limited events that you're seeing happen now, you know, post COVID, the majority of them are outside, from curbside seating with restaurants to there's a big uptick in people, you know, using public parks and going hiking and things like that. So obviously when you have open air flowing and, you know, outside of the confines of, a building, it's that much safer as far as, you know, being social distance compliant. So I think that outdoor events and if the outdoor venues or venues with some capacity, whether it's a rooftop, you know, partially outdoors, whatever, I think that that's the future indefinitely. And yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, myself, anybody else, Brooklyn Grange, people who have been ahead of this trend are sitting in a great place right now, building the infrastructure out for those kind of venues.
Right. So yeah, you're basically saying events is going to be good.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Definitely. Definitely. I mean, this summer was crazy though. I mean, the initial shock of the whole pandemic made people just completely shut down inside or out, which is why, you know, the events that I ran this year was scaled back from what it was projected. But I feel like as people warm up and as the vaccine rolls out and things like that, the outdoor venues are the future.
Who are some of the brands that you're collaborating with these days?
So in 2020, so far, I have gotten sponsorships or done partnerships with a company called Deer Busters. It's a deer fencing company originally based in Maryland. I believe they recently relocated to Pennsylvania, but they donated, I think, about 400 square feet worth of deer fencing for a site that I'm nice. A newer site that I just started leasing late last year. So provide us with some tools, get some key infrastructure set up there. I also have received support from the manufacturing company of my new greenhouse. They're called Rimmo Greenhouse out of New Hampshire. They make some of the best, hands down, the best greenhouses in the Northeast. Highest quality, and they supported me greatly through the build out of my greenhouse, and nice. You know, also offered a substantial discount. So and then also cool. I've also worked pretty closely with a local distillery. They're based in Hyattsville, Maryland, a few miles away from my Mount Rainier farm location. They are called Sangfroid Distillery. They've provided support to several events that I've done, free product, and we also have a working relationship as well. I custom grow herbs for them. Rosemary has been featured in some of their different gin varieties, and then also they donated 8 dwarf apple trees, so some heirloom apple trees that will fruit in the next 2 to 3 years and will be used in some of their fruit brandies. Wow. So those are some of the partnerships that I have in place right now.
What about the Mead Works? Aren't you growing for mead as well?
Oh, yeah. That's not really a sponsorship, but that's more of just they're a client. They're actually my flagship client. Maryland Mead Works is Prince George's County. It's our first meadery in the county. They launched in 2018. I met the owner, Ken Carter, at a local, I think it was like a craft beer festival somewhere around here. And I met him, and at that time, his location wasn't open yet. But I saw he was kind of, you know, gearing up towards that, tasting some of the mead, and I loved it. And I said, hey, do you ever use herbs in any of your recipes? I'd love to custom grow something for you. I just started an urban farm a mile away from where you're going to be doing business. And the rest is history. We just came to a multi-season custom growing agreement. And I grow a specialty herb called lemon thyme. It's like your typical thyme, but it has a lemon flavor to it. You really don't see this in any major, grocery stores or even health food stores. It's hard to come by. So I've been growing that for him, supplying him with, you know, anywhere between 4 and 8 pounds per season for different varieties of mead. And, you know, what I learned during the pandemic was that, what was reminded during the pandemic is that much of the liquor business is recession proof. Obviously, bars have gotten, you know, have gotten hit pretty hard with shutdowns and everything. But a lot of it's recession proof. And, you know, my business did not slow down with Shane Fraw and Maryland Meatworks.
Cool.
My name is Doug Adams. I'm the owner and operator of New Brooklyn Farms. New Brooklyn Farms is a urban farm, green event space based just outside Washington, D.C., in Prince George's County, Maryland.
All right, y'all, we got one last secret guest for today's episode. Next, we're going to be hearing from Stephen Wilder of Think Wilder Architecture. And we're going to dive a little bit deeper into placemaking.
So my name is Stephen Wilder. I am the principal architect of Think Wilder Architecture. We are a Harlem-based architecture firm. We also have office in New Jersey, partly because we do half of our work is in New Jersey, half is in New York. We're licensed to do work in other states as well, but predominantly we're in this part of the country.
Nice. Has your business been hit pretty hard by COVID, or how has it been adapting to the pandemic?
Yeah, I don't want to say pretty hard because we're still in business. It's very important these days to be as sensitive as possible, but also to be able to encourage at the same time. And no one wants to hear you're supposed to be at a certain place no matter what hit you, but also you got to work with what you got. And so we've been hit hard. We've lost some employees, we've lost some projects, we've had some projects delayed, and all of that means is that money has slowed up. And so if we're trying to be analysts and forecasters and think about it positively, we want to get to the other side. So now is about survival and really making it to when all of this stuff is over and that we can do regular business again. Because I think if you're able to survive this, then there's going to be a lot of opportunities just based on what we've learned in the last year. Like everybody, we've learned stuff externally and we've learned stuff internally. And if you're, you know, if you're a possessed business owner like I am, you sleep and eat and breathe this stuff. And so you really have your radars open to anything that can possibly help you.
Right. I know I've been hearing a lot about adaptive design, especially during COVID. Are you seeing more of those type of opportunities? Are you thinking about projects differently because of COVID?
The real thing is that are people going to change the way they live? Like, this is something that's hit us, but is it something that's going to change the way we live? Is this something that's going to change the way we gather? Because these are things that are essential to our soul, essential to how we live day to day. We need personal interaction. We don't even know how we're going to be affected due to the isolation that we've had to go through. I mean, all you got to do is look no further than people that have been incarcerated for years and just see how they return back to society and how a lot of times it's not the easiest transition. And I'm not comparing what we're going through anywhere near what they're going through, but for some people who have no idea what that feels like, this is kind of that culture shock, or this is that thing that kind of like, wow, I've never experienced this. And we've seen some of our peers, and we've heard and seen family members not be able to make it for whatever reason. And so as an architect, we're thinking about how are people going to live after this? So there's one thing, okay, what are the things that spread COVID? So we want to make sure that we're following all safety protocols that eliminate the spread of COVID. And so one thing that I have been doing is I've partnered up with Columbia University, and we've come up with a playbook to help small businesses when they decide to reopen to navigate through COVID. And so these are things that the information is out there. We're kind of here to help them redesign their space and if you're in a restaurant, how to locate your seating, how to make sure traffic is flowing in one direction, how to reduce your contact points, how you want your workflow to go. So those are the things that as an architect that we can provide value for, but I still haven't figured out how people are going to design places differently, because we don't know how people should behave differently. Everybody can predict it, but until you actually see it, you're just selling me on an idea that I'm not sure is going to work yet. And so the other funny thing about it is what's been happening. There's been like this, you can call it like urban sprawl in a sense, because everybody's going to where their parents live, or they're leaving the cities and they're going somewhere remote where they don't have to be close to their jobs because that's not required anymore. And although there hasn't been this large amount of emissions being released because people aren't traveling as much, the way people are living has changed. And are they going to come back to the city? And for the last 20 years, we've been trying to get rid of urban sprawl because we know that's bad for the environment. We know the more people drive, all of these things affect the environment and the quality of air. And so if we have COVID now, which is pushing us further away, which is something none of us really want, how do you marry the two? How do you put those two back together? Because COVID is going to end. This is not the first pandemic. It's not the first major scare. It's the first one of this scale for this time in our generation that we've had the experience. But everybody's itching to get back to their old habits. And since they're itching, that means a lot of people have not decided to change, obviously, because the deaths keep coming up. The pandemic has come. The second wave has come because people are ready to get back to how they used to live. And so I don't know if you can necessarily change that through design. I think you can just try to protect people from themselves. And that's kind of how I look at it.
All right, y'all. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Talk Dirty. Tune in next month to catch the second half of our conversation with Stephen Wilder from Think Wilder Architects. I hope everyone's having a wonderful holiday season and you're with your loved ones. And we're looking forward to seeing you next time.